So, a little framework where we've been the last few weeks. We've been looking, we're kind of using this this text called the Diamond Sutra as a foundation in a way to talk about a body of ideas that arose as kind of the second stratum or layer of inspiration in the Buddhist communities in the centuries after the Buddha, that came to be called the Mahayana, the Great Vehicle teachings. There's also the potential parallel translation that could mean not great vehicle, but great wisdom or great knowledge, based on the word jnana, knowledge, great knowledge. And particularly the figure known as the Bodhisattva that appears prominently and in a new way in this layer of the teachings. And there are these gorgeous teachings that seem to have their seed in teachings on the absence of a singular or separate essence in things, and especially in beings, the teaching of anatta in Pali, not self. When we go to look for myself, when I go to look for myself, what I find is this collection of experiences. I have an experience of a body, I have an experience of feeling that some things are pleasant, some things are unpleasant, I like some things, I don't like them. I have experiences of recognition or perceiving things. I have thoughts and feelings that analyze and make narrative and structure the world in my awareness. And I have the even like the bare or pure experience of just being awake, being conscious, being aware. All of those things I can notice. And our practice in meditation and contemplation is to notice these in profound subtlety happening all the time. Right? We settle in to feel the body, and what we find is a changing field of sensations and vibration and pulsation and ache and pleasure, and even though it's always morphing and never settles into one thing for any length of time, we stitch together aspects of how we know the body, and we understand that to be myself, my body. This is my body, right? I have my bodily experience, and the bodily experience of one who comes from this kind of family and not that kind. I have a skin color. I have a kind of bodily shape, a weight, a height, a look. And I have sensations that may be similar to your sensations, but I don't know, actually. And it's clear that the exact flickering experience of my body isn't shared exactly by anyone. So I call it myself. And these teachings suggest, and that's true for all of those things, my thoughts, my feelings, everything. But the teaching of not-self, of anatta, and of constant change says, look at all that stuff. Observe it very closely with a bright mind, and you find that everything's always flickering. Everything's always in flux. And if it's in flux, how could it be you in a kind of solid, permanent way? Because when I say me, I think that means something that sustains over time. It was me when I was 2, it was me when I was 20, it's me now. What is that me that sustains over time, even though everything I could look at to find that sense of me is shifting? With that intuition, that kind of radical hint at flipping our sense of what the world is like, here's me, here's things, on its head or unbinding it, this new body of texts appears, of which the Diamond Sutra is one, perhaps one of the earliest of them, that takes that proposal and almost like takes it to its furthest implication. It says, if that's true, it must be true about everything. And if it's true about everything, it's true even about the teaching that it's true about everything. Does that make sense? I'm telling you that everything's in flux and has no fixed essence, but that teaching is also true about this teaching. It's in flux. It has no fixed essence. You can't pin down the teaching as being one thing. If you have a historical bent, as I do, in a certain ordinary way, this is obvious, right? I'm not reporting to you what the Buddha said. I don't know what the Buddha said. I'm reporting to you what, perhaps if the historical narrative is at all correct, and it's only one narrative, perhaps I'm reporting to you what one monk with perfect memory said to a whole bunch of monks, and then those monks said to their students, and they memorized it for 400 or 500 years, and then they started writing it down in many, many different languages without a fixed alphabet. And that was passed down and recopied and recopied and smuggled across borders and destroyed in fires and appeared in several different countries in different versions that are all different. And after all of that, a monk in my lifetime translated them into English in a form that I could buy and read, published by a very nice American publisher in Boston. What a pathway. Is there any way that I can say that the Dharma that I'm teaching is the thing that the Buddha said? The Dharma is also, this teaching would then say, empty. It has no fixed state. And if that's true about the literal books themselves, how much more so about the subtle idea? How could I even know the subtle idea that a sage 2,500 years ago on the other side of the world, in the other hemisphere, visioned in a forest by a river on a spring morning? I don't know that air, that water, that the tastes that that person nourished themselves with. So we're suggested to start with the ordinary, but then very quickly blow it out into a vast realization that if everything is like this, nothing can be pinned down at all. Even the teaching and even the teacher can't be pinned down. Any gesture implodes upon making. Anything you do disappears as soon as it's done, and it's not done. So then we get this amazing line that we've talked about for 3 weeks now, because nothing else really needs to be said. It's the thesis of the text. So I'll read it again to start us off. The disciple says, Saputi says, "Blessed one, if a noble son or daughter should set forth on the Bodhisattva path, so should make the intention to walk this path toward wisdom. How should they stand, how should they walk, and how should they control their thoughts?" This is a standard question. How should they practice? What should they do? The Buddha told the Venerable Saputi, "Well said, Saputi, well said. It is as you say." And then he goes on to say what the Bodhisattva's practice is, but the practice is a vow. So here's the practice. The Buddha said to him, "Sabhuti, those who would now set forth on the Bodhisattva path should thus give birth to this thought. However many beings there are in whatever realms of being might exist, whether they are born from an egg or born from a womb, born from the water or born from the air, whether they have form or no form, whether they have perception or no perception, or neither perception nor no perception, in whatever conceivable realm of being one might conceive of beings, in the realm of complete nirvana, I shall liberate them all. And though I thus liberate countless beings, not a single being is liberated. And why not? Subhuti, a bodhisattva who creates the perception of a being cannot be called a bodhisattva. And why not? Subhuti, no one can be called a bodhisattva who creates the perception of a self, or who creates the perception of a being, a life, or a soul." So you have a practice. How should they stand? How should they walk? How should they control their thoughts? That consists not of standing or walking or controlling thoughts at all, but of giving birth to a thought. And that thought is a vow. First, it's an image. Whatever beings might exist, born in all these different ways, a cosmic invocation of beings in the vast plural, whatever beings might exist. And of course, beings even thought of, in whatever way one might conceive of beings. And I really like conceive here as a pun between think and give birth to. Lodge that in the sublime metaphor section of your heart somewhere. To conceive is to give birth to and to think of. The vow starts with an image of the vast, and then it says, in the realm of complete nirvana, I shall liberate them all. You make a vow to liberate all of those vast beings. That is the practice. And then it turns toward the wisdom piece. And though I thus liberate all beings, not a single being is liberated. We're dealing with vast beings, not single beings. Single beings aren't liberated. Why? Because anyone who gives birth to the perception of a singular being is not a bodhisattva. In other words, you're not doing the practice if you're thinking of individual beings, single beings. So the bodhisattva makes this glorious, absurd statement that they will liberate all beings, but see that liberation of all beings depends on liberating the mind or the perceiver or the bodhisattva themselves, whatever that means, from the perception of a self, including their own and others. So this is the practice that the bodhisattva is suggested to. So this thesis is at the root of this vast collection of texts called the Perfection of Wisdom texts, Prajna, wisdom, paramita, perfection. Paramita is also feminine and becomes not only a sublime quality or a perfection of the heart, but a goddess. And the practice starts to become the veneration in a sublime or esoteric way of wisdom as a goddess, as a feminine force that is beyond all distinction. So, of the many texts in the Prajnaparamita literature, there's a whole set of texts. Two of the most famous are the Diamond Sutra that we've been reading and the Heart Sutra that I'm recording on next week, and I'll talk about with you all a little later or something. It weaves in. It's probably the most popular of these texts in the world. But there's also a whole set of gorgeous texts that lay out the teachings in a much more vast way. And very central to these is a text called The Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 Lines. This is its old, boring cover version. And it's a... They're divided by their length. There's one in 8,000 lines, there's one in 25,000, there's one in 100,000, there's several kind of in the middle that are a little bit less important. And I think rather than saying what they are, I want to sort of ask Jason what it is. What is this text? By way of saying that one of the reasons I was excited to invite you here is that you, in the course of a long retreat, practiced deeply with this specific text, The Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 Lines, that I've taken to writing PP8K in a sort of Gen X kind of sardonic way, like MST3K, for those of you who were around then. You practiced on a long retreat with this text, and I mean, actually did the what I think of as a kind of devotional seva, but also an internal practice of recording yourself speaking the entire text, and then giving it away, and I've been listening to them, and it's many of these texts were, of course, and so this is a longer footnote about orality. The very earliest texts were oral tradition. These texts were actually composed in writing and then venerated as writing, but still come out of a social milieu where texts were chanted and intoned and spoken. And so it's sublime to hear or speak the text all the way through. So a whole practice unto itself, just engaging in a spoken word way.
Talk about that for the whole time.
Absolutely, absolutely. And Jason's a poet as well, so the word in its aesthetic is also present. So now I want you to just talk for 3 hours about your practice and your life. But maybe I'll start even just a little bit by saying, coming out of this sort of general overview, anything that you would offer around what this core vow or orientation has been for you in practice, and then anything that else that you feel would be enlivening about this, and then we'll chat a little bit.
Well, a couple of things came to mind since I thought, or found out that you were doing this, which I really want to say out loud that I'm celebrating, because this is such a precious text to me, and I think even just planting the seeds, sometimes something, years later will open up that we thought we understood, maybe understood intellectually. I was telling someone about this earlier today, that go over something, read it, type out notes, and then years later, the phrase comes to mind and an experience happens. I don't know how to explain it. Certain things have to line up. But to ground this in what's going on in our lives these days and in the world today, and there's a few ways of coming to the Bodhisattva vow from what I understand. Sometimes I think personally that all these texts that appeared around the same time within a couple of centuries, and Sean's probably talked about this, Avatamsaka Sutra, the Lotus Sutra, the Vimalakirti Sutta, and the Prajnaparamita Sutras, they all reflect this deep knowledge of the sutras, the Pali canon. And they all have the Bodhisattva vow, and this exuberant, vast imagery. And but what's really interesting about it is that something happened in the course of people practicing the historical Buddhist teachings that I think made them available to meet the world as it was and be more available to the suffering that was in the world. I think that's how the Bodhisattva vow and the development of these sutras being written down, obviously people were thinking this and practicing it for centuries before this. Yeah. This was not like something that happened in the course of an evening. So I'm thinking about this in terms of either coming to the Bodhisattva vow in 2018 as a result of just saying, well, historical Buddha says there's a way to end suffering. Well, there sure is a lot of suffering in my life and in the world, and I'm going to take that as a challenge. Something seems viable, something seems intuit that there's some, not just in Buddhism, but maybe some other religion, offers some kind of lasting response, really substantial response to the suffering that's in the world. So, I'm thinking about race and violence in the world and poverty, war, and coming from an activist background and also having an affinity with Eastern traditions, it started to seem natural to me to gravitate towards, making a vow to say, well, or putting my life to say, well, I'm going to study as much as I can, find the best things I can, and offer that. I was thinking as you were talking about how we don't really know what the Buddha taught, about how in generation by generation some things have been passed down and verified. I'm thinking how it's been like Chinese medicine, Tibetan medicine, Indian medicine. The principles have been worked with and passed on. And just like in Chinese medicine, they'll say, well, if something doesn't work, they'll pass it on. And they'll say, well, this used to work, but now maybe the conditions have changed. But the principles are sound, and people can work out the details generation by generation, culture to culture. Mm-hmm. So to find something like the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, or to kind of bring in a small element of the fact that texts can have power. They know this in Christianity. They talk about the power of the word. I have something on my website about that, just how people chant something or they reflect deeply or they venerate the sutra. And it seems like even beyond the translation or the imperfect speaking of it, there's like something that comes through that's...
Well, it's a mystery in Christianity and here. Like, why does it make, you know, why does it make an initiation more real? The technical term now would be performative. What makes it create a real change in the world to put your hand on the Bible when you say something, even if you're lying? Right? But something happens when you put your hand on the book. And you don't even have to have ever read the book. You know? But these texts start to say, you know, whoever memorizes one verse of this teaching and writes it down and venerates it and teaches it to others gains an immense body of merit.
So it's interesting that you reference that, and we're talking about, you know, Prajna, the perfection of wisdom, and usually we don't think of wisdom and then veneration. And one of the surprising things about reading through this and recording and editing and listening to it, how much devotion there is in it, how much compassion, it's pervaded by compassion, and how much a devotional element in it. I don't know if that's saying that you need this, these elements work together to kind of get the full sense of what this is communicating, but I wanted to mention one thing that, you know, people can take it up if it appeals to them, but after hearing these and responding to it, you know, going to Zen centers and hearing the Heart Sutra chanted and reading Diamond Sutra commentaries. You know, sometimes with these teachings, they say, I don't know if you've heard this in the Tibetan tradition, they say you need patience for people giving you a hard time and for your own difficult emotions. And they have a whole category for, third category for studying the wisdom teachings. It's like, hard as people are, hard as our own emotions are, really generate patience for engaging these things, you know, with a really interested mind and over a period of time. Because what will happen is maybe you reach some point and it's just kind of like plateau. Mm-hmm. And you never know what will move it then. But I came across Lama Zopa Rinpoche teaching on some audio teachings of him, Light on the Path series, teaching on the middle way. So I don't know if you know historically, centuries
talked
later.
About a tiny bit.
Nagarjuna and the middle way, but he made it very accessible. But it, what it did was, these are wisdom teachings in a continuum with anatta and then shunyata and then middle way teachings that are, it illuminates what comes before. So I think these teachings are a exposition, an expansion, a deepening, or a rephrasing of the anatta teachings. Mm-hmm. So the middle way teachings of Lama Zopa, I transcribed and I, you know, put together my own audio of, and you can find this on my website too, the Lama Zopa wisdom teachings that I linked to in the article about recording this. But it made it really clear, because sometimes, you know, just taking something on and saying, well, the key points of the middle way, you know, can that illuminate perfection of wisdom? And can I put it in the context of responding to the suffering in my life, in my family, in my culture. Yeah. You may know Shantideva, he said something like the beginning of the ninth chapter in his Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life. And one of the reasons it prompted me to delve more into this, he said, all of the Buddhist teachings were given for the sake of wisdom. So quite a statement. Mm-hmm. Precept. Meditation, you know, loving kindness, they're all good, but the bodhisattvas are doing Buddha's work by teaching wisdom, encouraging that in people. Yeah. So I ground that in looking at what the middle way teachings say about, you know, that grasping at a self is not volitional, it's habitual and reflexive. It's with us all the time until it's undone. As an act of, you know, by inquiry, by investigation, by seeing through it. And they identify something they call the refuting object, which might sound very technical, but it's really kind of aiming precisely at how we superimpose or we conjure, we conceive of something that it appears to be there. Things exist differently than they appear. That's the proposition. And one of the ways I look at it, like a mosaic, you were talking about different aspects of your life. A mosaic looks like one thing from a distance. It's a horse, you know, it's galloping through a field. And you go and you walk up to it and you see it's made of many things that are not horse galloping up to it and through a field. So in Zen they say first rivers and mountains are rivers and mountains, and then they're not rivers and mountains, and then they're rivers and mountains again. Right? They say this. So you go and you look at the mosaic of what you conceive of as a unified, independent, permanent self. Oh, it's made up of my family and my culture. It's these pieces that are mosaic. And in the mosaic, there are pieces. Let me get into Avatamsaka Sutra. We'll really start to deconstruct.
It's turtles all the way down.
Right. You can deconstruct this image that you have. And what the middle way and the Prajnaparamita say, that we do this all the time. Places and people and events and self. And I wrote something, actually, after listening to a couple of Sean's talks that he's given on this, and it was called Conventional Wisdom and Transcendent Wisdom. Because I was imagining like a piece of the Diamond Sutra, the Heart Sutra, blowing up on, along the street, and you pick it up, and you say, well, this makes sense. You know, how many beings there are, you know, born of womb or egg, I'll liberate them all. So, oh, yeah, okay, that makes sense. And then you get to the light, but then there will be no beings that, whoa. And you know, the conventional mind goes, I don't get that at all, right? It's bringing up conventional wisdom, the compassion aspect, and then saying that you need something more than conventional wisdom. You say, well, come to Berkeley Tuesday night at this time. This is conventional wisdom. Yep. We need this. Yep. But it shouldn't obstruct the wisdom that sees that these are all names that we give to things just to make our way through life. So I don't know how much of that makes sense, but what really is compelling to me, and the Tibetan thing go on to, you know, talk about seeing things as illusory and to see oneself and others as beings of light in the world, you know, translucent, not to grasp at anything, but to recognize its appearance. What's compelling to me and what grounds all this is just the thought that the proposition, you know, what's appealing to me and I think a lot of other Westerners is that Buddhism isn't dogmatic, you know, it doesn't say you must accept, you know, you recite these things, Four Noble Truths. It's put out as a proposition. You know, the historical Buddha says, you know, that suffering can be ended. Well, all right, I take that challenge, you know. And then you meet some teachers and you know, they have something really special about them, how they engage the world. And you know, I was meeting Thich Nhat Hanh or Boka Rinpoche in my late 20s, early 30s, gave me a reference point, you know, because I knew that they were, it was something very intriguing about how they carry themselves and how they express things out of their own experience. So it made me want to learn how they thought about these things. And, so I hope that these teachings spread and are put, if not always and by everybody, at least by people from time to time, right in the center. You know, the study of wisdom from different perspectives, you know, because you can analyze things and then rest with what you find on analysis, or you can make your mind very clear and quiet and open, you know, like the Enigma and Mahamudra teachings get to. And I think come to the same point, but there's such a need for greater sanity and peace and wholeness and connection with others, which I think, more than I think for myself, I'm very convinced that removing the false concept that we have about ourselves and others lets us see and be in touch with what's actually here, you know. Even if we then don't go and reify that into a self, Yeah, there's a dynamism and a richness and a depth here. And there's a reason why people honor other people. They say in Metta teachings, you know, that the cause of love is to see what's beautiful in another. And I think that the cause of treating others with respect is more than just a concept. It's actually seeing the value of another person, seeing the richness. And what gets in the way of that, and probably you can plug this into all the heated debates in the political sphere and people not communicating at all, really holding up all kinds of fictions about each other, upholding and fostering like great delusions about each other. So the I don't know if you're familiar with Swami Yogananda. There's a movie about him called Awake that's on, I think that's on Netflix. He was in the States. And when he traveled to the South and met with the Klan and the movement, the racism at the time, he was just astonished. You know, there's racism in India. But he said, oh, great delusion. You know, great delusion. Mm. It's like, right? Yeah. So so I celebrate this, the existence of this text and translators and teachers. And I wanted to offer this to Lama Zopa as a recording, just say here, you know, something that he inspired me to do.
Yeah.
And I hope that it's, you know, what the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras and the Buddha's wisdom teachings don't seem abstract to people, and they seem really practical, even if they can get into, like...
And they sure
schools
can.
Schools of philosophy debating each other that see, like, what, you know, table, you know, what's they're talking about table, you know? So I wrote one small book last year about, you know, ending racism from a Buddhist point of view. That if you don't mind, I'll maybe read a page.
Please,
from.
Please do.
Because you can probably insert all these other things into this one kind of page summary, whether it's gun violence or, you know, disrespect towards women or just militarism, you know, neo-colonialism, and just. We don't see each other as we are. You know, there's a lot of illusions. There's a lot of delusions. You could see it. And, you know, things that come bubbling up, they're below the surface and they come bubbling up.
I'm glad you brought that, because this is sort of the direction that I want to kind of bring in now for a little bit, is this this way that these wisdom teachings stack a perspective that that dissolves the perceived distance between myself and others. That perspective is vast and kind of blows away the sense of fixated identity and projection on others, but it's built on this foundation that I think you expressed beautifully of seeing the other and seeing suffering in the other. And understanding in a way that suffering is infinitely variable, that any given being, persons and families and communities and group of people and class of people's suffering has a distinctness to it. So then through the conventional or through the individual or non-absolute lens, we relate with suffering as a field of specifics, you know. In other words, when I'm remembering that there are, when I'm in the mode, whatever living beings there are, I'm engaging with living beings in their difference. Beings born this way and born that way, who live this way, who live that way. In other words, you're different from you, different from you. I was born a different way than you. You're in a sort of subtle sense, mm-hmm. right? So beings born in any way, which means everyone in their specificity. And then, and that's the place that's usually taken up by the activists, and I'm going to bring in this, like, okay, what do you do with this in a kind of concrete, here's the world, here's all the things that suck, here's all the things that give you hope. It's wildly, like, polarized and difficult and conflictual on so many levels.
Right.
And then, the teaching says, and then recognize that none of that is any more substantial than a translucent image in a dream.
So what might be a comfort when coming up against this key paradox or this apparent part what might be a comfort is that people have taken up this inquiry and this question, how do we engage beings if beings don't exist in the way we conceive of them, and help you know, without reifying? And people have taken this up and they've responded to it. And it's interesting because in the Prajnaparamita 8,000 line, this challenge is phrased in a few different ways, you know. Mm-hmm. Again and again, it's like they have these themes. There'll be a chapter on the, you know, praising Prajnaparamita, and there'll be a chapter on kind of like a dialogue going back and forth very creatively where they're just pushing everything to like the nth degree, drawing it out. Well, what about this? What about that? Mm-hmm. And then there'll be, again, this challenge. Well, you know, take up this vow, and how do you think about this? So, Shantideva, 8th century, 21st century, 20th century monk, they'll say the same kinds of things in slightly different language. You know, we engage beings as they see themselves, you know, as it's commonly understood. In other words, conventional wisdom, we don't deny that, negate that, we recognize it. But there's something more going on. Maybe, interesting, because if the stuff isn't grounded, you know, if it doesn't end up actually having a practical effect, even if it just on our own personal level just stays like a philosophical bubble, you know, well, maybe that's interesting, you know, a few hours, a few years, a couple of decades of, where did that time go? You know, but the promise of it, and I think the Dalai Lama has said this when they asked him, what's the value of having these teachings on Shunyata? He says, well, it gives him hope. He says, well, you know, it gives him hope that it isn't just talking about a temporary, isn't talking about harm reduction or a temporary respite from, but an ending of delusion. The delusion as the cause of suffering, referencing the historical Buddhist teachings. So, well, how do we work that out? You know, one of the things that's been a constant, I can go back to, is Eric Pemus Kusang has a website called Levenkunst that put some articles on there. And one of them is called Coarse and Subtle Mind. Well, if we take up these teachings with a coarse mind, you know, stressed out and distracted, it's going to stay on any teaching, not just this teaching, it's going to stay on the surface, or it's not going to really soak into the soil, you know. So I say this to myself, and then say the things that I think might be, are there universals rather than just my own peculiar kind of makeup. But whatever teaching we take of it, we take it up with a more subtle mind, you know, nourished by the best things in life. You can really go deep with it. It can be transformative, you know. So it's interesting because we may be talking about something unconditioned or like universal principles, but then there are all these factors that have to do with, you know, take care of ourselves, our body, or mind, our relationships, you know, ethics. There's an image of dependent arising that you probably come across of sticks leaning on each other. You know, like you need, this is a dependent arising to realize these things that are, you know, beyond causality or universal principles. So, anyway, I have another a text that I took out the word radical from because of the all the mounting connotations, but it's a, you know, Buddhism and progressive politics. And having seen my father, who was like, he's from Puerto Rico, and
mine too.
Oh, wonderful! We probably have relatives. But he's an activist and organizer in the '60s, and I saw him and I saw the activists out here when I came out here in '79, and the strengths and limitations of that, you know. And I started this by saying, this one on race, by saying, you know, why have we gone backwards, you know? Or reflecting on where Martin Luther King left and where some of the contemporary writers on race leave it. At the end of the book, they'll say, we need a revolution of values. We need to learn to see each other. What's the, you know, where do our values come from? They come from insight, you know. See each other as we are, not as we fear and imagine. And so, well, all right, that's the last page. How about starting there? You know, start with, we need to change our thinking about things, our perception. Mm-hmm. So, anyway, most of this I don't use Buddhist language because I thought that maybe some people who weren't Buddhists would think, oh, I'll see what Buddhists have to say. That, you know, people tend to, you know, be voracious when they get into certain topics in the street, everything's out there. So I wanted people to, as with the other, to take up a vow to dedicate themselves to finding deep response to some of these things. So only in one chapter do I use Buddhist language, but it's called Finding Medicine, Bodhisattva Vow, Samadhi, and Prajna. And I say, in these essays, I've stayed away, for the most part, from Buddhist language, knowing that not everyone who reads these words will be Buddhist. I've also taken up the challenge of expressing traditional teachings in new ways, so there's poetry and short, you know, parables. This is useful as far as it goes, but I want to introduce three factors using traditional Buddhist terms that are explicit, that are present in this book, but here I want to make them explicit. Sometimes traditional language is the most direct way to get something across. So first I talk about the Bodhisattva vow, because I think we need something stronger than just emotion. We need something really to ground, to have a something we can refer our life to that's going to be stable, you know, when we wake up, go to sleep. There's a proposition, at least, that this is really what we need, a kind of depth of commitment. So the Bodhisattva vow is the aim to awaken to truth so we can help others to reach peace and wholeness. We have to become the freedom from delusion, from false identifications that we're talking about, rather than have it be something we read about or just have a passing experience of. Once we've glimpsed the depths and beauty of our own inner life, it needs to be stabilized and revealed, as there's such a great need for all of our wisdom to shine forth in this world. Let's see. A vow can be something that's strong, middling, or weak. The strongest vows come from deep reflection done over time, with a clear mind. So you can insert the other problems in the world where I say things like discrimination, women's issues, or violence in the world. Thinking about how discrimination has harmed us and how it will continue unless the causes are addressed in full has to lead a person to the kind of dedication I'm talking about here. We should all cherish what I call a divine dissatisfaction that won't settle for easy or comfortable non-answers to problems we face. Nor should we settle for mere emotion that might feel good and be necessary, but that leaves us no better off than before. We need deeper answers, and that's the motivating force for the Bodhisattva vow. Bodhisattva is a man or woman who takes up the benefit of all beings as his or her life work, seeing the misery in the world, in our lives, and the lives of those we love. We aim with all we've got to alleviating the suffering and the cause now and the future. Then I want to say something about samadhi. Buddhist teachings say that how do we accomplish our aims? They say that in addition to great love and compassion, the motivation to help others, we need what's called samadhi, deep and clear meditation, and prajna, or wisdom. We might have a glimpse of some deeper truth about ourselves, but for that insight to be transformative, we need meditation. The mind has great power, but it needs to be trained, so whatever knowledge we gain can be fully integrated. Traditional teachings are quite clear in that in addition to a calm and clear mind, we need wisdom. In the Buddhist sense, wisdom is seeing through the illusions we have held and those of our society. Enlightenment is found right here in understanding thoroughly how mistaken perceptions come to be, how they can be brought to an end. This is our study as Buddhists and as people looking to end ignorance and its effects. So then the title of the chapter is True Medicine is seeing through all the veils, past our conditioning and the histories, something fundamental and everlasting, our noble heritage. This is what we receive and transmit across generations. So this is my attempt to ground this in this 2018.
Absolutely. Thank you. Part of where I where I go in hearing this is that one of the things that arises, I think, often in a kind of social action-oriented conversation around helping, around service, is, you know, this tension that you're that you spoke of and spoke of being present throughout kind of centuries of conversation about this, you know, that to serve beings who are suffering in part requires or seems to require, and this is the hinge, seems to require affirming a mistaken reification in because suffering meets that reification specifically. So for instance, you know, if I'm understanding beings as all part of, you know, a cosmic ecosystem web, race as a delineating structure disappears from that absolute perspective. It's not, it's, there's nothing tenable about it, right?
Well, what do they say about race being a construct? It is people widely accepted.
Even outside the peripheral, or even in ordinary materialistic history, race is a construct,
right?
Like there's no definition that holds. But oppression, of course, meets those illusory categories in specific ways and needs to be unbound in specific ways.
What you're saying about the Buddhas in each realm.
Yes.
Right? Maybe the six realms come from people's grasping at things as they appear. But the Buddhas see that and they also are not fooled, you know. It's like entering into someone's dream or illusion.
And of course it becomes literally that later in the Tibetan dream practice. This is an image I gave a couple weeks ago for those who might not be familiar with it. I think I talked about it. Did we do six realms? And Buddhas in all realms? Yeah. So six realms of beings, super comfortable heaven realms, warring realms, human realms, animal realms, realms of profound scarcity and loss and deep torment. And really a map both of, you can say, like the vast ecosystem of beings, how one might have a life, and of course, also a beautiful kind of inward or psychological map of mind states that we might find ourselves and beings do find themselves in an endless cyclical way is the whole point. The whole wheel grasped by a demon with fangs, Yama, the god of death. And in each realm, a little image of a Buddha standing or a bodhisattva, right? Part of this vow is, you know, I will go into the realms where they're suffering and be in them. And to jump traditions to my teacher Steve Hoskinson in the organic intelligence work, talks about us as practitioners becoming an island of coherence in our world. In each place we go, that whatever work we're doing there, our practice, as it matures, can have the result of us, even in ways that are perceivable by most there, or subtle, that we might show up as an island of coherence in that realm of suffering. And of course, Buddhas show up in all, there's no realm that's without suffering. So Buddhas show up and in a sense hold the ground while everything, you know, pours around.
There's we all know the basic wish, the metta, may beings be happy. And I wrote something about, you know, Buddhist prayer, you know, the fundamental Buddhist prayer, you know. And you think about, someone says, may you be happy. If you don't know what that person's mind, they can be thinking, may you have a nice margarita on the beach. You know, I remember this one story about someone offering the 16 karmapa some hallucinogens, right? That was in their mind. They wanted the precious teacher, here, have some. So, but someone who is a Buddha wishing someone to be happy, or there's a story of some Tibetan woman, a saintly woman, said, she would meet everyone, may you realize the nature of mind. That's what she'd say to everybody. You know. It was her instead of may you be happy, which we can interpret to, you know, may you have a good dinner tonight and sleep well and not have to work tomorrow. You know.
Have a good dinner and realize the nature of mind.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because you think, well, what is the Buddha wishing? And one of the places in the beginning of this, I'm thinking, contrasting what I've learned about people want equal rights, or they want things to be equal to what? You know, I mean, it's kind of like there's a kind of some bit of hangover of, you know, kind of Marxist or materialism, and if the highest happiness is, you know, just have our material life taken care of, well, that's different than what some people think of as happiness. And, you know, going away from this country for a number of years, I found that what it really highlighted for me was having to explain what's kind of distance between what people thought things were like here. Yeah. You know, the countries where with very little, they just imagined that if they were here, all their problems would be solved. It was really interesting, like a bubble would come up that would be very hard to forget about breaking it, you know, like, no, this is, you know, if you're in America, it's like, wow, there's food, grocery stores are full of food, you can eat anything you want.
I want to do a very on-the-moment quote today, because I heard Terry Gross interviewing James Comey this afternoon. They recorded it yesterday. And one of the things he said, interestingly, with what you're just saying, is he said, what is America? He said, America is a collection of ideas. So, and he was referring to, like, you know, what are we if we break our deep kind of institutional structures of belief in equality? Like, he's talking the optimistic American language, and there's a way to critique that deeply, of course, yes. And he admits something, whether you agree with his position or not, he admits something that I think is interestingly true. America is an idea. But a lot of places with people, you know, if you go to someone who was like lives in Ireland, their family has lived in Ireland for 100 generations, they are Irish. And you say, what is Ireland? They might not say, like, it's an idea. They might be like, well, it's this place where my people live. Like, it's emplaced and embodied in a different way. But this is a different kind of place, and founded with a different tragedy than the long and planted, you could say, indigenous nations. I don't think, you know, a Lakota person, if you ask them, what is Lakota, they would say it's an idea. I don't know that. But that's not the kind of thing you hear.
I thought you were going to say, if you ask them, what is America?
Well, if you ask them, what is America, they might say, let me tell you the kind of idea.
Right,
it is.
or the idea my father had of this country.
Right,
and
right.
So maybe it's a mosaic also, you know, of many ideas. And some people, I mean, think about, like, when you watch some, you know, patriotic presentation, it's an idea. So I was realizing that people have a very different history, very different story that they're telling when they come up to this point where certain actions, militarily or voting this way or that way, make perfect sense. The backstory for them, it leads it right up to that.
Right. All things being conditioned.
Right, a different backstory. You know, so, you know, to break it down, it isn't just one thing that results. I mean, it's kind of one of the practical and optimistic points about studying something like the Heart Sutra or Diamond Sutra, that things are not fixed, so they're workable. If things were fixed, you know, game over. Kind of like, well, what are we, you know?
There could be no liberation if things were fixed.
Right.
Or no fixing at all.
Or things, you know, that appear, well, here's kind of like the characteristic that they point out in the middle way, too, that things appear to be fixed, you know, whereas it's actually, our ideas may be relatively static, but even those ideas change, you know, if you really watch them. So,
as we close, we will we'll come back next week, and we'll kind of start right back here where we are, and we'll weave in a longer discussion period. This was our discussion for the evening. So I'm sorry we don't have time for questions and discussion. Actually, this would be a point then to begin talking. So we will continue talking in this way, and really taking up from this point. And interestingly, as we will proceed a bit, kind of in just some little chunks through the sutra, continuing with this beautiful paradox of how really coming back to Subhuti's question. Okay, but if I was Subhuti, I'd be like, that's great, but how do they stand? How do they walk? Like, that's what I started with. And there's a way that's like, yeah, what's the bodily expression of this wisdom? What do you actually do with people? And because this is this is strange, paradoxically and beautifully, it's a teaching that suggests that the transcendent is what liberates, but the entire practice is about seeing beings. And that that becomes just a beautiful seed for action in the world that's not bound to the past, bound to conditions and their endless kind of habitual reinforcement. So we'll continue in that direction. Jason, thank you so much for coming by. Really
a pleasure.
A pleasure. On Jason's website is like hella shit, like all sorts of books and beautiful both essays and just kind of stuff that's more scholarly, stuff that's more aesthetic. I believe you're also a classical guitar player.
I separated out all my stuff,
you know,
and just put them on my own website, but in 2004 I made a website that I brought together all my favorite things from different Buddhist traditions and other world traditions. Someone said it should have been allmyfavoritethings.com, but that wasn't very descriptive. So it's
might have been taken also.
Yeah, it's a BuddhistLibrary.com. I took most of my stuff off it and put it on my own website, but the Buddhist Library has all my favorite things from all the different Buddhist lineages, and so
awesome.
That's a good reference for people if they find some teacher that they want to find what school they're from and traditional teachings.
Awesome. Blessings. Thank you so much. Thank you so much, everybody. As always, we are here in the first of the great perfections, which is the perfection of giving, or dana. Traditionally known, we call it the gift economy. Here, your offerings of your resources in a very direct way sustain us to offer this practice freely to all. So thank you for your generosity. You can put offerings in the wooden box in the back or at the desk via cards and things. You can buy Jason's books and listen to his speaking things online. And
if resources are an issue, contact me and I'll make it not an issue.
If resources are an issue, contact. When one can just make things not an issue, what a siddhi.
We have to do what we can.
Yeah. Thank you for that. Awesome. See you all soon.
Thank you. Sean, are you not here next week because you're in Colorado?
No, I'm totally here.